listening once per week at 7 p.m. Thursdays.
Hello. Welcome to Razor's Edge, local and independent current affairs straight from Sydney on 2SER 107.3. I'm Daniel Butler. Today on the show, a new report out this week details the harassment received by women on the streets of Sydney. The organisation behind the data has used a new and innovative way to gather the information, hoping to make our streets safer. Also on the show today, Sydney's waterways are our crowning jewel, but are we taking good care of them? We speak to the experts about the health of our harbour. All of this and more coming up on Razor's Edge. My brain is alive, my body is alive. Don't notice me, that's not what I want. But first, in this year's federal budget, funding for the national infrastructure is expected to increase by $25 billion, up from last year's target of $75 billion. Western Sydney is a big focus. A north-south rail link is in development, costing the government $3.5 billion. Roadwork packages are also in action. But will projects like this solve Sydney's renowned congestion issue and distribute equal job concentration? Bella Filicuridi spoke to the director of the Centre for Western Sydney at Western Sydney University, Philip O'Neill, to explore the concerns of urban growth steering infrastructure.
In your field of research, what has been the common discourse surrounding infrastructure development in the Western Sydney region?
Well, over the last 10 years, it's been the lack of infrastructure development in Western Sydney. I think more recently, it's been the issue of the concentration on transportation infrastructure, particularly on the development of motorways. And that's obviously not sustainable. So there's a concern about how do we properly configure public transport configurations.
So following that, do you think that infrastructure spending hasn't really addressed the concerns of the community that efficiently in regards to public transportation?
Sydney's population growth at the moment is 2 or 3 times its historical average. And we haven't had the public transport infrastructure built in the places that is needed, so people have obviously resorted to their motor vehicles. So the recent infrastructure expenditures, such as in last Tuesday night's budget, is on things to fix up road transportation, to bust congestion, as they've been saying. So we've got ourselves into a situation where we actually do now need to spend on road transport to ease the problem. While we wait for public transportation to be built. So that's the problem we've created. We're allowing these new residential estates vast distances away from the city centre and those professional workers that actually do rely upon CBD employment because there's inattention to the development of professional jobs elsewhere in Western Sydney. It's quite mind-boggling that that's the way we're designing a city in the second decade of the 21st century.
Just following that, how does the state government really navigate urban trends when developing infrastructure? How do they kind of anticipate these patterns when they are doing future planning?
Well, I think the problem is that the pressure on the state government from landowners at the moment is to produce quick value uplift. And the quickest way that a person who owns a lot of land on the edge of the city to get a lot of value out of it is to have it rezoned as residential. And we don't seem to have any pressure to stop that happening. Now, where people live only becomes a problem if it's a long way from where they work. So what we're doing is releasing a lot of land for new residential estates, but paying almost zero attention to the development of big agglomerations of jobs that are near to where people live. And of course, that makes the public transportation task easier. If you have concentrations of jobs near to where people live, then it's a hell of a lot easier to build light rail or buses or so on to connect them, which of course is exactly what happens in the CBD. We have a giant concentration of jobs and it's not surprising that people cluster in denser configurations of residential areas around the CBD and Overwhelmingly, the people who work in Sydney CBD go by train and bus.
And you mentioned that infrastructure is chasing urban growth. The root cause of this is that infrastructure spending should steer urban growth, but in actual fact, it's doing the complete opposite at the moment. Can you talk to me a little bit about that?
Look, I think there's a bit of a mantra around that infrastructure steers urban growth, and that's sort of true. But it's more true when you say that infrastructure and jobs concentration steer urban growth. Often in the past, we've had a concentration of jobs in regional centres and then residential areas spring up around them, and then you can connect by rail, light rail and buses and so on. What we don't have in Sydney at the moment is an attention to concentration of jobs, because that's very hard. If you've got such glorious CBD like Sydney with beaches along its eastern edge and a harbour right down through the middle, it's very easy to attract enterprises to come into that beautiful location and coexist with all the other enterprises. The funny thing is about most cities of the world don't have a beautiful harbour and beautiful beaches, but they do have successful concentrations of jobs. Now, a lot of that occurs because governments make considerable effort to actually making places amenable to commerce. And what we don't have in Western Sydney is that sort of serious attention by governments to do the things that are needed to build those giant jobs concentrations, not just in Parramatta, but in Liverpool and in Campbelltown and in Blacktown and Penrith and the other regional centres of Western Sydney. Now, unless you do that as an urban planning project, then really public transport has no job to do, because there's no destination for public transport to be built, no destination for it to arrive at. At the moment, we're very good at building origins, places where people live, but when they get up in the morning, their jobs are scattered everywhere.
And have there been any talks about those type of urban projects that are trying to build that job concentration?
I suppose the good thing about the Greater Sydney Commission is that it has acknowledged the problem. And there is now in a number of documents the aspiration for 200,000 new professional jobs in what they call the Aerotropolis area, adjacent to Badgerys Creek Airport. Now, there's a couple of problems with that. One is that we're not really sure if we can create 200,000 knowledge jobs in such a location. It takes a big leap of imagination to think that by 2056 there'll be 200,000 professional jobs there. To give you an idea of what that looks like, so the new Barangaroo development in Sydney will create 25,000 jobs. So in other words, an Aerotropolis in the outer southwest of Sydney would have to be the equivalent of 8 Barangaroos, and we have to build those 8 Barangaroos by 2056. So it's a mammoth task. So certainly there's government awareness now of the size of the task, but as yet governments really aren't, I don't think, aware enough of how difficult a task it is and what they need to be doing in order to generate jobs.
The Infrastructure Australia's priority list, have they used job concentration as a priority when tackling that list?
Yeah, no, it's an interesting question. When Infrastructure Australia was established in 2007-8, you know, it would be fair to say that the Infrastructure Australia now operates more on a business evaluation model. What are the real and implied monetary benefits that you would get from that investment? And if you discount that through time, will that produce a net present value that makes the whole project worthwhile? So we really do have a business management approach to decision-making about infrastructure rather than a broader city-building approach.
And I guess that goes hand in hand with the whole public-private sector relationship that is really in a lot of these infrastructure projects.
That's true. And I mean, it's always an issue in the Australian federal system, in that federal government is always paramount when you need infrastructure built, because they're the ones with the deepest pockets. But the major builders of infrastructure are the state governments. But of course, the third player in the 21st century in infrastructure is the private sector. So we have a new problem, which is that we need to assemble coalitions of federal government, state government, local government, of course, and the private sector. And that's a new thing in human history, and we're not very good at it, and we need to improve the way we do that sort of thing quite quickly, I should think.
Philip O'Neill, Director of the Centre for Western Sydney at Western Sydney University, ending that discussion with Bella Filicoridi. I'm Daniel Butler, and you are listening to Razor's Edge on 2SER 107.3. This is Razor's Edge on 2SER 107.3. Plan International is an organisation that encourages the welfare of women the world over. This week, they continued the fight. Plan International releases reports into the public safety of women in cities around the world. The latest reports were released on Tuesday this week. They detail incidences of harassment covering a spectrum from inconveniences to much more serious physical or verbal abuse. Hayley Cull is the Advocacy and Community Engagement Director at the Australian arm of Plan International. She outlined some of the key findings for the Sydney report.
In Sydney specifically, we've found that most of the group harassment that occurs happens on the street, and it is largely young women in their early 20s who are victims of this kind of abuse, but a lot of the time it starts much younger, and we've heard from girls as young as 13 who are experiencing harassment by groups.
In the data collected, users were asked about where the incidences occurred and to describe what happened. Hayley says a clear pattern emerged.
A huge amount of the harassment in Sydney is taking place from vehicles. So it will be groups of men in their car or in their van who are shouting things out the window. And for a long time, this kind of behaviour has been brushed off as kind of banter or as some kind of harmless fun. But we're seeing through this research that girls are actually finding these experiences really quite terrifying, quite humiliating, and quite often they can really stick with them for a very long time and cause them to rethink how they might participate in the city, and sometimes cause them really serious anxiety or distress as a result. So it's really anything but harmless.
This problem of entrenched attitudes is a serious one. Apart from quantifying the abuse received by women on the streets, the report seeks to look deeper into the reasons why it is being perpetrated in the first place by, it has to be said, men.
And terrifyingly, what we've found is that men and boys are often seeing harassment and catcalling and abuse of women as a form of entertainment and male bonding. And that's sort of causing them to try and gain status among their male friends through this behaviour. And it's really quite terrifying because it has a really long-lasting impact on girls and women and on the way that they are then participating in their city and in their streets.
These findings on men's behaviour are not based on men's responses to the report. It solely takes women's responses. But Hayley says the sheer quantity of the testimonials, hundreds and hundreds of them, was enough to put together a picture of harassment faced by women on the street.
And so because there's been so many of these reports that we've been able to look at, we've been able to start to identify patterns of behaviour and some of the characteristics of that group behaviour. And we've seen things like repeated laughing, egging each other on, the kind of comments that they're making to each other while they're perpetrating this behaviour. And we've also seen that the men and boys in those groups who might refuse to participate are then being socially isolated from that group, or they're being ridiculed by their friends. So we start to see these patterns around male bonding that are emerging there. We've worked with researchers at Monash University, and they have really done a lot of analysis of all of these different patterns to be able to come up with the results of the report.
The data was collected using an innovative technological approach.
This research was a result of our free-to-be tool, which we have been running in Australia and in countries around the world for some time now. And it asks girls and women to drop a pin on any place on a map in their city of where they feel safe or unsafe. And then they can share their different experiences about that place, what it is that makes them feel really particularly safe and welcome there, or what it is that makes them feel a little bit intimidated, or the experiences that they've had in those places. And as a result of that, we found that there were some really positive places that were shared, but in a lot of the instances, it was negative experiences. And in most of those, it was as a result of some kind of harassment, largely verbal and sexual harassment.
Are there specific locales that were particularly bad for women when it comes to Sydney?
More broadly in Sydney, we see that a lot of the public transport hotspots can have a lot of negative experiences, particularly around places such as Central Station. It does change at different times of day, and night times can be quite worrying. But really what it starts to find is that, unfortunately, there is nowhere in the city that is entirely protected from this kind of behaviour, and it starts to show that it's actually an issue of our social norms and our culture more than it is just to do with the city itself.
Due to one well-known and distressing aspect of harassment, Hayley says the technological side to the data collection was crucial.
Around about 90% of the experiences that we've collected through this tool have never before been reported to authorities. So we know that by making this a digital tool that's anonymous and that's easy to use, we know that we're starting to uncover experiences that girls or women may have either felt too embarrassed or ashamed to report to authorities, or that they might have thought authorities wouldn't take seriously. And so that starts to give us a picture, really, of just how everyday and just how insidious this behaviour is, where sometimes it's only the much more severe forms of abuse that might be reported.
The data also threw up some unexpected findings. In sifting through all of the testimonials submitted by women in Sydney, the researchers discovered minorities were facing a particularly high level of harassment. Many responses were concentrated around Newtown's King Street, an area with high queer representation. The report also contained high levels of abuse directed at people of colour and people with a disability.
These people quite often are experiencing these things in a much more severe way than many others. They are deliberately targeted, particularly queer communities in and around Sydney, and we feel as though this is something that the research has picked up that we really need to see addressed. This is very much a women's and a girls' issue, and that includes women in all their diversities, and we really want to ensure that the responses that authorities and others are taking are inclusive of all of those perspectives.
For now, the application is being set aside, its purpose of data collection being fulfilled. But while it presents many unwelcome findings, not many women would be surprised by them, it being a lived reality. Going forward, Plan International hopes to use the data to change that reality.
You're listening to Razor's Edge on 2SER 107.3.
I'm Daniel Butler and you are listening to Razor's Edge, coming to you live from this place known as Sydney on Gadigal land of the Eora Nation, of which sovereignty was never ceded. Well, Sydney Harbour may look healthy and well, but research is showing there is a high level of CO2 emissions in the estuaries. Runoff rainwater containing hazardous substances from roads and vehicles is proving to be detrimental for marine life in the harbour. Dr. Edwina Tanner, Coordinator of the Marine Studies Institute at the University of Sydney, spoke to William Gleeson about why this is happening and how protecting the environment can start with you.
What exactly is happening in Sydney Harbour and its estuaries in regards to carbon emissions?
Okay, so Sydney Harbour is one of these large drowned river valley systems. So it has a classic funnel shape. And if you go up to the tributaries of Parramatta River and Lane Cove River and Middle Harbour, you'll see they're really narrow and quite shallow tributaries. And they feed into this very large, dynamic, wide harbour area that feeds out to the ocean through this the heads. So there's this nice free exchange of water down the bottom with the ocean water. But up in the top estuaries, so the upper estuaries, it's very narrow and quite degraded up there. So you get a lot of bacterial action. You get a lot of what we call high retention. So the water remains in those areas for a long time. And as you go down the harbour, it flushes quite regularly. So around Parramatta, Lane Cove and Middle Harbour in the top of those estuaries, you get very high CO2 emissions. So they can come up to be up to about 5,000 parts per million. And just to put that in perspective, the atmospheric CO2 component is around 400 parts per million.
Where exactly do these carbon emissions come from?
So estuaries are naturally dynamic systems, and within the estuary there's a lot of phytoplankton and bacteria. So these phytoplankton and bacteria respire and photosynthesize within the estuary. And in the upper estuary, you get an excess of respiration happening. So a lot of microbes respire a lot because they're degrading organic compounds. So that gives off CO2. That creates an excess of this inorganic carbon or carbon dioxide in these upper estuaries. And that is released through the air-water interface. And as you come down the estuary, you actually get a lot more phytoplankton. So the phytoplankton actually start working harder and they actually absorb CO2. So they actually use CO2 to photosynthesize, and they release oxygen. So down in the lower estuary, you get these marine phytoplankton that are working, and they are actually creating fish food by absorbing the carbon dioxide and photosynthesizing, creating carbon in their body mass, and then releasing oxygen. So this is kind of why the estuary breathes. It's in response to the biological activity that's going on within the estuary. So decomposition and mineralization in the upper estuaries, which actually is taken over by photosynthesis by phytoplankton in the lower estuaries. So that's why you get these different dynamics happening.
How does a high level of rainfall affect Sydney Harbour and the estuaries?
Okay, so when you get a high level of rainfall, what happens is you get a large influx of nutrients that come in through either sewage overflows or extra runoff from the catchment. And what happens in the Sydney Harbour estuary is the extra nutrients in the upper estuaries, they stimulate increased respiration, so you get very high levels of CO2 emissions. But as you go down into the mid-estuary and the lower estuary, it starts causing this biological pump to increase. So the phytoplankton are stimulated because they have more nutrients coming in. And because the water is aerated, because it's flowing through nice and fast, then this stimulates the biological pump. The biological pump is what happens when you get this drawdown of CO2. So the estuary, instead of being what we call heterotrophic, which is a source of CO2 emissions, actually becomes an autotrophic system. And so it absorbs CO2 right through from the middle estuary down to the lower estuary, which is actually quite amazing. You can actually see the estuary kind of breathing and letting out oxygen and absorbing CO2. It's quite intense when you get these high levels of rainfall.
How does this affect any human or wildlife living in the vicinity?
Okay, so if you think about the upper estuaries where you've got a lot of decomposition and microbial respiration, if you're a fish living in the upper estuary, you're going to actually have a very hard time breathing because these microbes are using up the oxygen and creating a lot of carbon dioxide. So you can actually see, I've been up in Lane Cove, right up in the upper estuary there by the weir, and you can actually see the fish jumping out of the water to try and breathe because it actually is using up all the oxygen. All the microbes in the water are using up the oxygen and decomposing. Whereas as down in the lower estuary, the fish are, free to breathe. There's lots of oxygen and there's also a lot of fish food being created for them through these phytoplankton.
What needs to be done to look after Sydney Harbour and the estuaries?
Well, there's a lot of things that we can. First of all, don't litter. Also, we need to remediate our stormwater system so that we're not getting sewage overflows so much. Also, one of the biggest problems of pollution is also heavy metals that come into the system, and that's through a hard-paved urban environment. So you think of all the cars driving on the roads. When it rains, all of that exhaust fume is washed off the roads and ends up in the harbour, and that creates a lot of deterioration in the upper estuaries as well. So we need to really clean up a whole range of systems to keep our harbours clean. We have done a fairly good job in the lower estuaries. We've had a lot less pollution coming in through industry, which is really good. But then we also have marinas. So we have marinas and boating activities that go on. And along with those, there's fuel and there's bio waste. And there's poisons that are used to keep, marine growth off the boats. So there's really a huge range of activities that need to go on, but they really start, you can start with an individual, which is do not throw your waste away. Cigarette butts are one of the very largest plastic wastes that we find, so don't put your cigarette butt out the window.
Dr. Edwina Tanner, coordinator of the Marine Studies Institute at the University of Sydney, talking there to William Gleeson. Well, that's all we've got time for tonight. Thanks for listening to Razor's Edge on 2SER 107.3. Razor's Edge is produced on Gadigal land of the Eora Nation. Catch us again next week on Thursday night at 7:30. Catch us again next week on Thursday night at 7:30. I'm Daniel Butler. Till next time.